Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Every day, about 10,000 Americans turn 65, often unprepared for their retirement, and many are unaware that the retirement system has changed drastically. Workers who had always felt secure because of their union benefits or government employment discover that their pensions are underfunded, and the real estate crash in 2008 wiped out much of the home equity that many were counting on to support themselves. 1/3 of all Americans have no retirement savings at all. These days, people of retirement age who discover that they're ill-equipped to find a new job in a competitive market make up the fastest-growing segment of an insecure and low-paid labor force. In her new book, Catherine Newman, a professor of sociology and interim chancellor of UMass Boston, argues that the coming crisis in retirement security is the result of a flawed system, not flawed individuals. Her book, Downhill from Here, Retirement Insecurity in the Age of Inequality, is published by Metropolitan Books, and it brings Catherine Newman to our show now. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Leonard.
In the middle of the Great Depression, how was FDR able to gather support for the newly created Social Security program?
It actually was more of a struggle than we realize now. Social Security was not all that popular when FDR first proposed it. You would think it would be because during the Depression, you had so many families that were suffering both in terms of taking care of their children and their elderly parents. And that was a huge social force leading in that direction. But actually, FDR had to get out there and lead ahead. And in the initial years of Social Security, it wasn't all that popular because it took a long time before it actually took effect. But eventually, it became a third rail and no one will touch it now.
On the other hand, some of the arguments that were used against the New Deal are still with us today, arguing about proposals to correct the current situation.
There are plenty of people who would argue that we should dismantle Social Security, that it was a socialist idea whose time has expired, but I don't think most Americans believe that.
Why did FDR base his economic security proposal on social insurance rather than on welfare assistance?
Because I think he thought it would have more political traction if it was something that appeared to be earned over a lifetime, which of course it was. You had people who worked for 40, 50 years and paid in and then saw this contribution coming back. And so I think they thought it was morally acceptable.
Based on insurance.
Yes, it was concept. An insurance model, exactly.
But despite the weaknesses in the system, hadn't we long believed that we had solved the problems of old age poverty?
Yes, and perhaps if we weren't living so long, we would have. But the Social Security system was designed for a period in which people typically died in their 60s. And now we're living well into our 80s, if we're lucky, and some even longer. So Social Security was not designed with this longevity in mind, and that's one of the reasons why it's somewhat vulnerable. Not difficult to fix, truly, if we had the political will, but it just wasn't designed for this demographic.
So people are living long enough to actually draw the benefits, or they're drawing benefits longer.
Much longer.
Than they would have in the past.
20 years longer.
Are monthly Social Security benefits too low to allow most retirees to make ends meet?
It would be difficult without any other source of income. And of course, for those more affluent Americans, they have private pensions, as is true in most of the world, where the state system is meant to be a complement to private insurance. But I think for as a foundation under the vast majority of Americans, it at least provides a kind of modest living. And that's not unimportant to millions and millions of people.
What's a defined benefits pension?
A defined benefit pension is the kind that used to be typical in the U.S. for about 30% of the population, especially the unionized population, where you put in a contribution was put in by employers. It was managed by employers. It usually was a function of the last, say, 3 years of your salary. So in the University of Massachusetts, it's one of the last places where this exists. Our workers receive a pension benefit that's pegged to about 80% of their highest salary over the last 3 years. And that's what a defined benefit is. It means you know what the benefit's going to be going out. And that is the opposite of what most people have now.
But since the worker is guaranteed a set amount of monthly income in retirement, doesn't that place the investment risk on the plan provider?
Yes, it does. And that was the whole idea. It places the risk on the employer's shoulders, and it places the responsibility for managing the investments to make sure that money is there on the employer's shoulder. It's the opposite of the 401k system we have now.
So they didn't want this anymore because it wasn't working for them. So is that why a defined benefit system has largely been replaced by what's now being called a defined contribution pension?
Yes, well, this is linked to the weakness of unions, which were able at one point to bargain for defined benefit contributions, and then union density slipped, and pretty soon you didn't have that bargaining power anymore. And what replaced it, as you said, is the defined contribution plan. That's where the amount of money that goes in is defined, but what comes out is now the worker's responsibility to manage. And those are very ratable benefits, and people do rate them when times get tough. As a result, they're often not there for them when retirement comes around.
I've actually been seeing ads on television for people encouraging people to raid their life insurance policies.
Yeah, these ratable policies are a real problem. And during the Great Recession in 2008, 2009, people did this by the millions. And as a result, not a lot left in those plans when they really need them.
Where does the 401k fit into this?
It's a defined contribution plan where workers put in money from their paychecks, and in many companies they're matched or there's an employer contribution. But how they're managed is entirely up to the worker, and most of us are not that intelligent about investments. So how much is left there is vulnerable to stock market fluctuations and to the level of skill and knowledge you bring to the task.
So since the benefits are no longer defined, in fact fluctuate on the basis of investment earnings, how can a worker plan ahead?
Well, it's not easy, and they don't. And that's why we're in so much trouble, because as you pointed out in your intro, about a third of Americans have no retirement savings at all. And a great large number of the rest of them have very little. And so they're not going to have enough. There just isn't going to be enough when they're ready to retire.
When I was a kid, I was encouraged to open a savings account. And that was the way you were supposed to continue doing that through the rest of your life, and eventually you'd have a little bit of money there. But we started off, I think, with dimes at the Dime Savings Bank here in Brooklyn. But interest rates on savings have been around zero for a decade now. So thrifty seniors who kept money in a savings account or a CD haven't been able to rely on interest to supplement their income.
That's right. They're not getting anything for their money. And let's face it, Leonard, most people don't save. They live to the edge of their income. Their savings was tied up mostly in the houses they own.
Home equity.
Yeah, home equity. And of course, that tanked completely in 2008, 2009, and hasn't really come back in many parts of the country. So the real saving account was home equity, and it isn't there for an awful lot of people now.
So would you say that the defined contribution pension system fails to protect workers from cyclical turbulence and from poor individual choices? We're caught in a bind there.
Well, it's a combination of that and the fact that most people just don't have enough money to save. They need the money they're earning to survive. And if they have to depend on what they can set aside, it's never going to be enough. So what we need is something that's a more progressive system, more durable, and more untouchable so that we can't raid it.
You say a more progressive system. Has anybody proposed a more progressive system?
Well, Social Security is a progressive system. Those of us who earn more pay in more, and those who earn less actually derive a larger benefit. But everybody derives something, and that's an important political point.
But there's a cap on Social Security benefits as well. You could earn a lot of money and still get the same amount as somebody who earned a lot less money.
True, but by the same token, the amount you're taxed for it is cut off at a very low level, in my opinion. So if you're earning up above, I believe it's $135,000, all the rest of your income is not taxed for Social Security. And if it was, even at a modest rate, we wouldn't have to worry about the solvency of Social Security at all.
So how did that get through?
I think that was a political bargain like many other political bargains. And of course, in other countries, that's not the way it works. And so they don't face the insecurities that we do.
I'll talk about other countries later. Right now, there's an article in today's Times about how Britain is, young Brits are suffering, but much of Europe, people feel a lot more secure. We'll get to that later. But let's talk again still about people in this country. You interviewed a number of long-distance truckers. Weren't truckers able to support their families and have a stable life because of union benefits? They were members of the Teamsters Union.
That's right, they were. But we fell in love with deregulation, actually, even before Ronald Reagan, and then he accelerated this. But even under Democrats, there was sort of a mutual love fest across the aisle for deregulation. And the consequences of that, which began in the late 1970s and have continued apace, really wreaked havoc with industries like the truckers, communications, the airlines. Just all over the country, we started inducing, and by deliberately inducing, much more competition. That then led to companies disappearing. And as they started to disappear, they began tapering off on their legal requirements to fund pensions, and pretty soon went belly up completely. And that left the pension funds high and dry. So in the case of the Teamsters, the Central States Pension Fund began running down in the 80s and then took a really heavy hammer in 2000 and in the Great Recession. And pretty soon that fund was coming to an end, and Teamsters started getting notices that they were going to lose 50, 60, 70% of their pensions.
Unionized companies like Holland Freight faced stiff competition from non-union companies. So didn't they ask their workers to accept wage cuts with the promise of more generous retirement packages?
They did. But that's not what happened in the end. They asked for it in order to stay above the flood line and keep themselves going. But in the end, they couldn't very easily. And so, yeah, that benefit didn't ever transpire.
You interviewed a woman named Rita Lewis, who is both the daughter of a trucker and the wife of a trucker. And her husband, Butch Lewis, was willing to give back 15% of his annual pay to keep Holland Freight in business. Did that help?
It helped for a while. But in the end, Butch and all of his other union friends found that they were getting these notices saying their pensions were going to be cut. Butch Lewis was a legend in Minneapolis. He was the leader of Local 100 and became one of the spokespeople for Teamsters who were losing their pensions. But in the end, they were not able to bargain effectively because it was just a weak industry by that time.
In 2015, the Lewis family got a letter stating that 50% of Butch's pension might disappear. And thousands of others also got that letter.
All across the Midwest, that's right.
So how did that come to pass? Disappear? They'd already given back money to sustain their pension plan.
As the Central States Pension Fund began to decline, the people who were running it petitioned the federal government to cut those benefits, largely in order to leave anything behind for today's workers, because these were the folks who were already retired. In the end, Congress decided to set that aside, but it's still a looming threat, and my guess is it's going to come to pass in the end. But Butch and his friends went out on the campaign trail to try and block the Treasury Department from approving those cuts, and it was extremely tense, and in the end, Butch died.
But also, people felt betrayed by their union. After all, they had made a major commitment to the union. On the other hand, the Teamsters were investigated for their ties to organized crime years before. Were there concerns that the union leadership might abuse the assets from the pension fund?
No, I don't think so. I think that in the past, the Teamsters...
Jimmy Hoffa was good about the pension fund?
Most of the Teamsters I've talked to were actually big fans of Jimmy Hoffa Sr. The federal government was not. And so it took over the Teamsters Central States Pension Funds. And that's why
the Treasury Department
was running the pension fund. And in turn, it turned it over to Goldman Sachs and other investment houses to take care of those funds. And they invested them in schemes that turned out not to be worthy. And in 2008, 2009, these junk bonds, you know, came to fruition, and it was a disaster for the Teamsters and for millions of other Americans. Their pension investments went up in smoke.
And you would think that Goldman Sachs and Northern Trust and some of the others would have been more responsible.
You would think that we would hold them more responsible, but that's not what happened. And of course, millions of Americans discovered they didn't have anyone they could hold responsible. The Teamsters were not the only ones in this fix.
I'm speaking with Catherine Newman on Leonard Lopate at Large today. Her book, Downhill from Here, Retirement Insecurity in the Age of Insecurity, is published by Metropolitan Books. Now that the stock market has largely recovered, is there any hope that these losses will be restored?
In the entire recorded history of the U.S., there is only one company that has ever actually returned benefits to pensioners once they righted themselves, especially following bankruptcy. There are no other examples, so I wouldn't hold my breath.
And what was that company?
I've forgotten its name, to be honest.
I would be very happy to boycott some companies, but on
the other hand, the good ones should
actually get our business. Did the truckers feel anyone was fighting for them? How about Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders or some of the other people who present themselves as workers' advocates?
I do think they felt Elizabeth Warren was, and I'm not sure. I mean, I imagine Bernie Sanders would have fallen into a similar category. I saw Elizabeth Warren deliver a stinging critique of the industry and of cuts to these pensions and a robust advocacy for these union members, as did Sherrod Brown, as did many other legislators who derived from the Midwest and were advocating for their citizens. So there were many who stood up, but there was also a kind of sense of complicity because pension reforms that were introduced in 2014 made these cuts possible. Before that, they wouldn't have been legally possible.
They were called reforms?
They were called reforms, and I think they were intended to support the needs of current workers, to make sure that if pension funds were going bankrupt, something was saved for the next generation. But the fact of the matter is it was just a disaster for almost everybody.
That was during the Obama administration?
2014.
There had been earlier problems with the welfare reform bill of the Clinton administration. So this is not just a Republican-Democrat thing.
No, it's not. And fortunately, now that the Democrats are back in action in Washington, there are bills before Congress to restore these benefits and to create a more secure pension system. We'll have to see how they fare. My guess is the Senate won't be in the mood.
Well, for a long time, Democrats relied on the support of unions. They no longer have to worry about that because the unions have lost so much power and so much membership. So is that another factor in the story?
It's definitely a factor in how we got into this fix. The unions were the major stalwart supporters of these pension plans, and as they weakened, so did the pension plans. But I don't think we've seen the end of this. We're seeing teacher strikes in red states. We're seeing millennials who are embracing policies they hope will help to right matters, because this is not just a problem for old people, Leonard. This is every generation that comes after the baby boom is going to be in worse trouble. And so it's
everybody's
issue.
So Gen X is going to have to deal with this as well.
Gen X and everybody coming after them, because if you think these things are bad now, we just wait till you see what generations who are in the gig economy have to look forward to. Not much.
You mentioned the deregulation of many industries in the 1980s. As companies were pressured to become more competitive and cut costs, didn't many of them raid their pension plans to improve their balance sheets?
Yes, they did. It turned out that legally they sort of owned this money, and if they needed it, they could swipe it, and they did.
They owned the money that I was putting into my pension plan?
Technically, yes. And so this is something we need to pay attention to legislatively, because when they started to falter and go into bankruptcy, people like you and me were at the end of the line, if even in the line, for our stake in a bankruptcy. So shareholders could claim their piece, but pensioners were not even in the list. I think that's one of the reforms we need to look at. If we're going to make sure that working people are taken care of, they should be in line.
And even some of the companies that we just thought were rock solid had problems. Ma Bell, the Bell telephone company, offered solid careers for managers and technical experts for many years. But you talked to a woman named Lisa Hannigan. What's her story?
Lisa Hannigan and her husband both worked for an institution you and I remember, but many of your younger listeners have probably never heard of, called the Yellow Pages. Mm-hmm. You know, the Yellow Pages were the main advertising vehicle for the Ma Bell system. But as the internet grew and we get our information as consumers from other sources, the Yellow Pages started to fall out of favor. So the workers who worked for the Yellow Page division of Ma Bell suddenly found themselves out on the outs. And as Ma Bell itself fractured, first into the Baby Bells and then into the Verizon system, responsibility for those pensions begins to get further and further away. And eventually, the Yellow Pages employees were spun off into something called IDARC. And IDARC was a company that was basically born to go bankrupt. So they put all of the responsibility for the pension system for those workers into IDARC, and within a couple of months of its creation, it went completely bankrupt.
You say IDARC was actually spun off to... That sounds almost illegal. This is Verizon doing this?
It was challenged. It was challenged in the courts, and the problem was proving that there was intent to create a company that had no other purpose than to die.
So it wasn't a functioning unit. It was just a way to offload billions of dollars in pension liabilities?
That's right. And in the end, that's exactly what it did.
And that's Verizon that runs all these ads on television telling me how great they are?
Yeah, well, it's and what's really shocking to me about Verizon and some of the other examples in that part of the book is that these were very profitable companies. I mean, the Teamsters were working for companies that were really struggling, but Verizon is not a struggling company. It's quite prosperous. It always has been.
No, Lisa never actually worked for IDARC, but then she found her health benefits decreasing, and finally they were eliminated.
Yeah, virtually nobody really worked for IDARC because IDARC never functioned. But that's what happened. Lisa and all of her Yellow Pages fellow employees were shunted into this basically fake company that never really functioned. And that was the end of that.
And they also eliminated cost of living adjustments, even though retirees are entitled to those increases.
That's right. They almost never got them. So watch what you're entitled to. It doesn't always happen that way. And, of course, if you have a pension that is adequate today, 20 years from now, the cost of living will have risen. It won't be.
How is Verizon, which is a profitable company, able to use legal loopholes to evade its commitment to its retirees?
Because there are legal loopholes there, Leonard, and
who gave us those loopholes?
Well, the legislation that set up these kinds of pension systems enabled this, and we haven't been wise enough to tighten those provisions, and we need to, because there are millions of people who are vulnerable to losing everything as a result.
Didn't Verizon also replace its management pension plan with insurance annuities?
Yes. Verizon its policies affected its workers up and down the line. This wasn't just the people that you see outside, you know, repairing telephone lines. This was everybody up to
working
and including
on the Yellow
management.
Pages.
In fact, in many ways, management was the first to feel the hammer blow because they didn't have any union protection. And many workers who had the opportunity to go into management refused to do it because they knew that they would be even more vulnerable. So they stuck with the unionized side of Verizon. But it didn't help forever.
So retirees are now getting their monthly payments from Prudential Financial.
That's right. And as long as that's stable, that's fine. But it turns out there are many responsibilities for being transparent and for informing workers of what's in their pension accounts that don't apply to the insurance companies. They apply only to the pre-existing pension system, which was not an annuity system.
It's a way of moving retirement benefits out of the reach of federal law and oversight?
Out of the reach of what's called ERISA, which is a major federal law that governs pensions. And so, you know, we haven't seen a tremendous fallout from that yet, but we hadn't seen 2008 before we saw that. And a lot of things can go wrong, and if you don't have the right to know, it could be a problem.
Didn't a group of Verizon retirees sue?
They did. They haven't won yet, but yes, they did.
Oh, it's still in the courts?
It's still in the courts, and we'll see where that goes.
Have there been any cases in the courts? Because it seems to me an awful lot of people have been affected by the changes you're talking about.
Not that I'm aware of in talking to the kinds of lawyers who deal routinely with these matters. Not yet.
Verizon was one of the first financially successful firms to invoke pension freezes and other changes to defined benefit pension plans. Some other pretty major companies followed suit: IBM, Motorola, 3M, Boeing, FedEx, Hewlett-Packard.
Yeah, welcome to the new world, Leonard. This has become a standard practice, not just an unusual one.
Once they saw that one of them could succeed at this, they said, how about me?
That's right. And of course, to some degree, these are competitive industries, so they're watching their prices and their costs, and this is one way they were able to lower them and be more attractive to banks and financing when their balance sheets were less loaded.
After United Airlines went bankrupt, how did they get court permission to default on their employee pension plans?
Because our bankruptcy law does not place pensions as a kind of creditor in the same way they do other creditors. And that, I think, is something Elizabeth Warren ought to look at, since she's a bankruptcy lawyer, because they really didn't have much standing. And as a result, yes, the courts discharged these responsibilities and let other creditors go way ahead of the pensions, and that was that.
Didn't that hurt United Airlines? After all, they rely on some highly skilled, well-paid employees, pilots, engineers, mechanics.
I guess they don't think it did. In the beginning, United, of course, was part of the air traffic controllers strike that Ronald Reagan pursued long, long ago. And the unraveling of the labor agreements surrounding the airline industry began there and then gathered force. And I think in the beginning, the pilots didn't think this would ever hit them, but it did. It hit pilots, it hit stewardesses, it hit the whole industry. And so pilots today are a highly organized force. They are very skilled, and they're difficult to replace. Not impossible, but difficult, because it takes so many years to become a trained and qualified pilot. But in the end, the industry was able to affect their pensions as well. And so, yes, they've gone, and there are pictures in the book of them walking picket lines, trying to claim their pension benefits back. But United did ultimately actually go bankrupt. It came out of bankruptcy later, and today is a very prosperous company, but it hasn't returned those pensions.
Meanwhile, I would imagine pilots have a certain amount of job fluidity. They could have gone off to Delta or American or one of the other airlines.
I don't think United was alone. The whole airline industry was restructuring. There are airlines that we knew very well in my youth and your youth, and they don't exist anymore, like Pan Am. I mean, there's tons of airlines that just disappeared.
And I'm assuming that things got even muddier recently with the government shutdown.
They certainly did, although the government shutdown was absolutely fascinating from this point of view, because it was the air traffic controllers in many ways that brought the government shutdown to a shutdown.
They unionized, but you mentioned Ronald Reagan going after them.
They did. I mean, PATCO was the enemy for Reagan, and he fired 11,000 air traffic controllers in one day and then prevented them from reclaiming their jobs later on. So, interestingly enough, the air traffic control system is a very sensitive point. If the airline industry comes to a halt, the rest of the country comes to a halt, and that was just not on even for Donald Trump.
Well, Donald Trump has come to the defense of airlines because he's against any of this new green movement, which he says is going to shut down airplane flights, although it wouldn't.
Whole nother topic for a whole nother one of your guests.
I'm speaking to Catherine Newman here on Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI, New York 99.5 FM. Her most recent book from Metropolitan Books is Downhill from Here, Retirement Insecurity in the Age of Inequality. One of her previous books we discussed at another time is No Shame in My Game, the Working Poor in the Inner City. So you're specializing on these kinds of topics.
Don't
you ever get depressed?
No, it's a mission for a social scientist to try and educate people about these issues. I think they're very important for the public.
Well, you're a professor of sociology at UMass. What happens when you talk about these things with your students? Do they say, oh my,
yes,
I'm
they
in
do.
Trouble?
I think they understand that they need to be educated about what awaits them and to pay attention to who they vote for and what policies matter, and our job in the classroom is to make sure they're well-educated.
You may have noticed that this show has been preempted a couple of times since this Winter Fund Drive began, and we're scheduled to be preempted again on Wednesday and Friday of this week. Some listeners have told us how frustrating that's been for them. To be honest, we don't like the preemptions any more than you do, but it's unfortunately the only way to keep Leonard Lopate at Large coming to you every day. And we are back with a discussion of retirement these days. Nothing like what it was, the discussion we might have had 10 or 15 years ago. My guest is Catherine Newman, who has written a book called Downhill from Here, Retirement Insecurity in the Age of inequality. And I mentioned 10 or 15 years. When did it really start going bad?
I think the beginning of our problems really dates back to that period of deregulation that started in the late 70s under Jimmy Carter, really took flight under Ronald Reagan, and has continued apace since then. But it's a slow bleed, and it's becoming more serious now. I think it became particularly catastrophic after the Great Recession, when one of the backstops for retirement, home equity, began to crumble. And I think it's become ever more evident since then that we're in trouble.
Weren't public sector jobs generally thought to be stable, even if they were relatively low paying?
They were.
And you were sure that you were going to get a pension.
That was one of their major attractions. And for people in cities like Detroit, where I write about in the book, it was kind of a promised land, the city, so-called city job. And here in New York, the same thing was true. People understood they weren't going to get super high wages, but they got good benefits and a stable pension to rely on. And that's why the civil service was kind of the holy grail, especially for people who were locked out of other professions.
Has this hit the African-American community particularly hard? Because in many cases, people couldn't get jobs in the private sector because of unstated racial bias, were able to get jobs for the local municipality.
That's right. I mean, whatever else you can say about municipal government, it was a haven for African Americans, and it was much more likely to respond to equal opportunity. Government has always been more open to progressive policies around equal opportunity, which is why African Americans by the millions flooded into the civil service, and it was, for many, a ticket to the middle class.
Among a number of factors that contributed to Detroit's bankruptcy, hadn't Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick used municipal funds to purchase risky financial instruments called interest rate swaps? What was his reasoning in doing that?
He was looking for higher interest rate returns, and that's partly because the pension systems in many cities are underfunded, and he was looking for more cash coming into the pension system. And it turned out to be very risky. It turned out to be an unfortunate decision. And that people debate today whether or not he should have known that. Mixed results on that. And he wasn't the only mayor who did so. But essentially, cities began to feel the bite of migration outward of industry. And the tax bases of many cities, including New York City, began to feel that hit and become underfunded in their pensions at the same time that they were struggling to pay for schools and medical care and all of the other responsibilities cities have. So they were looking for higher returns on those investments in order to fund city services.
But Detroit seems to be an extreme case. The city often borrowed funds, they called it, from retirement accounts instead of raising taxes. And this came as a shock to me. Didn't Detroit even consider selling paintings from the museum to raise money?
The Detroit Institute of Fine Arts is one of
it's a great museum.
Great collections of paintings and sculpture. But when the city's retirement system began to crumble, the question of how it could be rescued came up. And for many workers, you know, paintings are fine, but if we're talking about whether they can survive, that's more important to them. And so what were the assets Detroit had to look to shore up these promises? And the paintings were considered. In the end, that didn't happen because foundations in Detroit stepped up and began to create alternative savings opportunities for the city. But yeah, it was certainly considered.
Pensions in Detroit were not only cut. Weren't retirees required to give back thousands of dollars in pension payouts that had already been distributed?
That's right.
Has that happened anywhere else?
It has happened in other places. It's usually because some sort of mistake has been made. And in the Detroit case, the argument was that pensioners had been overpaid for certain kinds of benefits, that it should never have been cleared. Of course, they were cleared. They were cleared by pension authorities. And the workers, on the other hand, had every reason to think they were being given legally defined payments. How were they supposed to know that this wasn't on the up and up? And in the end, the bankruptcy court declared that either they had to give this money back on a monthly basis and pay interest, or give it back in a lump sum, and most of them didn't have the lump sum.
Yeah, it must have been a terrible hardship for people of modest means.
It was a hardship. Sometimes it was as much as $60,000 because these were payments made by mistake, shall we say, over a period of more than a decade. It added up.
Detroit was the first municipal bankruptcy in the U.S. Have there been others since?
There have been others. Detroit was the largest. There have been others. Three other cities in California. Of course, Puerto Rico has been in deep trouble. And there are lots of other cities, including New York, that are underfunded. They're not declaring bankruptcy, but there's the question of how these benefits are going to be paid is still on the table.
We recently did a show on cause and effect, and the reason, the easy reason given for all of this, the cause was Detroit stopped being a major manufacturing center.
Well, that was relevant for sure, because Detroit's industry began to flee. But some of the other problems that attended Detroit, including the fact that you have suburbs around Detroit where the residents are making use of Detroit as a place of work and are commuting in, but they're not paying taxes to support the city of Detroit. So there are lots of complexities about who should be supporting cities. Is it a state responsibility? Is it a city responsibility? And in many instances, Detroit doesn't even collect the taxes owed to it by commuters who come into the city.
New York theoretically charges commuters some taxes, at least taxes on their wages.
Well, it certainly has payroll taxes, but at one point New York had a commuter tax, and I believe that was struck down by the courts. So this, we haven't really come to grips with what is a city as a fiscal unit and who really owns it, just the residents of the city or the people who benefit from its presence because they work here, even if they're commuting from New Jersey or from Livonia in Detroit. I don't think we've really come to grips with that.
Haven't many cities like Chicago underfunded their pension plans despite being in good financial shape?
That is certainly true in many parts of the country. It is. They're kind of rolling the dice and hoping that those benefits will not be claimed as they could be. And it's always a matter of probabilities, Leonard. It's never 100% of everything is claimed, right? People die early. They don't get around to it. So there is always a matter of proportion and probability here. But I wouldn't want to bet on it, and it is something that every pensioner has the right to expect.
Are people still retiring at 65?
Less and less. Interestingly enough, the largest growing population of workers in the U.S. are full-time workers over the age of 65 and over the age of 75 even. Really big either returns into the labor market or people who never leave.
Don't some people wait until the full Social Security benefits become available at 67? Does that bump up the payments at all?
It bumps them up enormously. And if you can wait, it's by far the best thing to do. But of course, if you're one of those Teamsters whose body is worn out, whose pensions are cratering, then you take it the minute you can get it. And at age 62, that's a much less amount of money than you would get if you could wait.
Aren't women more likely to leave and re-enter the workforce?
Yes, because women are often the ones responsible for family care, for elder care, and so their patterns of movement in and out of the labor force are more volatile than men's.
Does that have an impact on the retirement benefits?
It does, because retirement benefits are cued to the number of quarters you've worked. And so for women who drop out of the labor force for long periods of time, this can really hurt them when it comes to claiming that pension check. And if they're not married or if they've been divorced, in a sense, the system was born with the idea that a woman was going to attach her husband's Social Security. That's not really how life has played out now.
Well, if you're a widow or a widower, don't you get the Social Security of the deceased?
You do, if you were married. Fewer and fewer people are. So it's, yes, the system was born with that in mind. And if that's how your life works out, those pensions are available.
How much of an increase has there been in the so-called gray labor, people working into the late 60s and 70s?
It's massive. As I said, it's the largest growing population of American workers, people over 65, either coming back into the labor market, but not usually for the kind of job that they used to have.
Well, many blue-collar jobs require physical strength and stamina. What options are available for older workers who did physical labor who need to keep working?
So take a look around the next time you go to CVS or Walmart or Home Depot, you'll see a lot of people with gray hair who are serving in those service sector jobs. And that's one of the kinds of jobs that people have come back to. And very often these jobs pay less and are of less social status than the ones they left. Nonetheless, they are looking to that gray labor market to satisfy their labor needs.
You interviewed older people working in retail and service sectors, Home Depot and the like. Did they talk about the problems of living on minimum wage jobs?
They did. Now, to be fair, some of them said, look, I'm not ready to be on a shelf. I want to be out in the world. And if I'm living longer and I'm healthy at the age of 65, why shouldn't I keep working? So the phenomenon we're describing isn't just motivated by hardship, but for many people it is. And for them, it's not only a consequence, they not only have to live with lower wages than what they were used to, they have to live with a certain amount of what they perceive as disrespect.
And then there are the problems of some areas being more expensive than others.
For sure.
And that is not built into any of this.
No.
Living in New York is a lot more expensive than living in some small town.
And Social Security is not means tested. It's not adjusted by where you live. So that is a big problem. A Social Security check will go a lot further in some places than others. In this state, this city, it doesn't go very far.
And you said earlier the retirement situation may be challenging for today's elderly, but it's going to be even worse for the Gen Xers who were born between 1965 and 1980. They'll be coming up for retirement fairly soon.
Yeah, and the problem for
should
them—
Should we increase? Some people have proposed extending the retirement age to 70.
We have already extended it to 68 in Social Security, so I think we can expect to see that the retirement age will grow— not only in the U.S., but elsewhere. And there's some wisdom to that. But again, we have to remember the inequalities that exist in the kinds of work that we do. If you have a hard physical job, by the time you're 60, your body is going to be worn out. Because the one thing we haven't been able to change is the body. And if you're in a job like mine, you could theoretically work for much longer.
What are two-tied retirement agreements?
So two-tiered retirement.
Two-tiered, I'm sorry.
They tend to come about when we're in the middle of a labor crisis and companies don't want to get too close to the moral hazard of attacking retirees or people who are imminently going to retire, but they will start monkeying around with the benefits for the next generation because they are maybe 10 or 15 years away from retirement and at least in theory could continue to work longer.
Well, why have labor unions agreed to such an unfair practice?
Because they're so weak, unfortunately. They are looking at extinction in many parts of our economy. And as the labor unions have weakened and their clout has weakened, they've ended up in a position of not being able to support all of their workers. And so they reluctantly and with great trepidation enter into these two-tiered agreements. The problem, of course, is their younger members don't look upon that as any great gift.
There's a morale factor there when people are working side by side who have different prospects for the future.
That's exactly right. And then it weakens the appeal of unions for the next generation.
And then we have this other situation now. Rather than hiring full-time staff, many companies are relying on short-term fixed contract temporary workers. At a university, we're going to be doing a show soon with adjunct professors who really are abused financially, and they don't have any retirement packages either.
As it happens, my university doesn't have very many of those. We have non-tenure-track faculty, but they have durability of employment after just a few years. But we have very strong unions in Massachusetts, and so some of the things that you see here in New York in the way of adjunct labor don't pertain much to where I am, but it has become a national issue all over higher education, and it has not improved the quality of their working lives or the quality of instruction that our students are receiving because they're stressed. They're working six different places to make ends meet.
Would you agree with Paul Krugman's solution to future Social Security insolvency? Eliminate the cap on income subject to payroll taxes?
Absolutely. It's the most sensible and easiest
thing. The cap is now $132,000.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think people earning above that limit would really miss it very much. And if we did follow Krugman's suggestion, we would take care of the Social Security system all, you know, automatically.
You mentioned Senator Sherrod Brown as one of the politicians thinking about these things. What would he's the Ohio senator. What would his proposed Pension Rehabilitation Administration legislation accomplish?
So it would allow pension systems to borrow to create a pool of funding that they could then use for paying benefits. It would put more money into Social Security. Sherrod Brown has been one of the most progressive voices in protecting pensioners. It would dismantle some of those so-called reforms that were put in 2014 that made it easier to raid pension benefits, and it would shore, most importantly, it would shore up the pension benefit guarantee system, which is an insurance system for pensions, the PBGC. We're not putting in a lot of money into that, and it's going to go bankrupt too, and so his legislation would stabilize PBGC, and we desperately need that.
It's being called the Butch Lewis Act, named That's after right. the Teamster we mentioned earlier. Why do you think the U.S. lacks a strong shared commitment to ensuring a decent retirement income for all members of society? When you look at some of the European countries, Great Britain's having problems right now, but France, Germany, the Scandinavian countries, they don't have economies as large as ours, and yet we're not hearing similar situations developing.
I would say that's true of their social benefits more generally. So pensions are just part of a broader perspective on what the state owes citizens and what citizens can expect from government. Now, they pay much higher taxes for it, but everything from childcare to old age care, all of it is regarded very differently in those countries than it is here. And we pay a huge price for this in insecurity, in inequality, in the especially the conditions that our least fortunate people endure. And there's much greater equality on all of those benefit programs in the social democracy. So the answer to why their pensioners are in better shape has to do with how everybody's in better shape in those countries.
So when your subtitle refers to insecurity in the age of inequality, there's less inequality there. In this country, when somebody proposes a millionaire's or a billionaire's tax, at one time in this country, after World War II, when the economy was really thriving, the tax rate for the very rich was very high.
It was about 90%.
There were loopholes, but it was very high, and everybody just thought that was okay. What happened?
Good question. Well, we lost political faith in that idea, and the country became more prosperous, and more, I think, middle and upper middle class people wanted liberation from those tax burdens and didn't realize what would come along with that liberation. Along with that would come insecurity. And so we have a whole system and economy now that's based on high levels of inequality, with those at the top whose political power is stronger being more favored by every one of these policies than those at the bottom. And so we only rarely ask the question, what are we paying as a country for this level of privilege for those at the top? And I think that's what people like Bernie Sanders began to ask, and it seems these ideas have gained more political traction now.
But the president and members of his party are taking credit for the recent tax cut, and they painted it as something that would help everybody in this country.
Well, we'll see whether or not that's what everybody thinks when they go to the ballot box. I think the empirical evidence is that's not what's happened. The benefits have accrued as they generally have in the last decade or two to people at the top.
And yet we are seeing right now a major campaign against fixing any of this. I just saw an article in the Times about all the lobbyists for various groups, including doctors' groups and pharmaceuticals, all upset that some of the new proposals.
This is a political battle, and I think it's actually a healthy thing that we recognize there is a political battle.
Yet the elderly seem to be voting for the politicians who don't seem to be voting in their best interests.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. You know, when they realize that those tax benefits didn't actually help them and that they're more insecure, we'll see which way the pendulum swings next time.
When you talk about this in, because you've been doing the book tour, when you talk about this in other cities, what kind of response do you get?
Pretty much the same I expect as here in New York, which is a recognition that it's about time for us to pay attention to these issues, that we owe something to those of us who are getting older, and that everyone will get older if they're lucky enough. So this is a universal question, not one that just pertains to one generation.
I'm always amazed by how politics changes everything. For example, so-called Obamacare was originally Romneycare in your state of Massachusetts. He was a Republican governor, and it was actually, wasn't the idea actually floated by the Heritage Foundation, a conservative group? So what happened?
Well, Massachusetts is an interesting state. Republicans in Massachusetts would probably be Democrats in many other states. But I think essentially the idea was to look toward improving efficiency in the healthcare system and recognizing that universal coverage is far less costly than most people think. And if we pursue it, then all those expenses that crop up for those people who are uninsured begin to diminish. So the Massachusetts experience has been a pretty positive one, and I think that's what gave this traction elsewhere in the country.
Catherine Newman is a professor of sociology and the interim chancellor of UMass Boston. Her latest book, Downhill from Here, Retirement Insecurity in the Age of Inequality, is published by Metropolitan Books. Thank you so much for being on our show.
And thank you for having me, Leonard. It's good to see you, as always.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Catherine S. Newman, to Deborah Freeman, who produced the segment, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lent. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.